Good morning, everyone. I'm excited to be here. It's going to be a good day. I am caffeinated, medicated. I'm ready for today. So things are a little bit different. If you missed earlier, grab one of these cards from the chair in front of you. Fill it out. Helps us pray along with you and for you throughout the week. Things are a little different today, aren't they? I don't know if you noticed, but I've been exercising. I'm just kidding. No. Obviously, yeah, no, never. Things are different today, and it's because our VBS, our Vacation Bible School, starts tomorrow. I made the mistake of saying next week like 14 times last service. So if I say next week, I mean tomorrow. We good? Okay. So the theme this year is Christmas in July, and I love it. I thought it would be a really interesting chance to look at Christmas today, this morning, from maybe a bit of a different angle. First, though, I want to tell you about our VBS offering. So every year, we support and raise money for some sort of project, some sort of initiative. This year, we're raising money for Christ Reaching Asia Ministries, some of our missionaries that we support year-round that are in different countries throughout China, and I think that's like all I can legally say. But this year, we're raising money sort of like Operation Christmas Child, if you've ever done the shoebox thing. We're raising money to get Christmas presents for kids in Asia who would not receive them otherwise. And each year we have some milestones that we're trying to reach along the way and a certain little reward that comes with it. So this year at our family night on Thursday night, there's going to be a dunk tank. And if we raise $250, I will spend some time in the dunk tank. I don't know how I drew the short straw this year, but like truthfully, they drew it for me. I blame Brandy. If we raise $500, our VBS director, Kelly Corey, who's volunteer and has done a terrific job this year, she'll be spending some time in the dunk tank as well. $1,000, Brandy Swafford, our children's minister, will be in there. And $2,000, Doug Vernon, our senior minister, will spend time in the dunk tank. That's right. I don't know what they bribed him with or how they convinced him to do this, but I have been informed of a new stretch goal. If we raise $3,000, not only will Doug spend time in the dunk tank, he will do so in a suit and tie. So I'm really excited to see that. And just going to put this out there, if anybody has $2,000 or $3,000 that like you need to get rid of or something, you don't have to be a kid, you don't have to be going to VBS, you don't have to have a kid, we would love to anyone wanting to help meet that gap and make this happen, because I think this is once in a lifetime kind of opportunity. So let's take advantage of it, people. That's enough about VBS. October 23rd, 2010 is the day I became the luckiest dude in the history of all dudes. That was my wedding day. And look at how cute we were. So young and didn't know what being an adult was like. All the hope has not drained out of our face yet. It was an awesome day. Like, I love my wife and her sisters and her mom, like, did such a terrific job with the ceremony, planning it all. It was beautiful. We ate tacos at the reception. It was like a great day. I loved it. And then, shortly after, we went on a honeymoon and we went to Venice Beach, California, which I was excited about. It's sort of, if you've ever been to the Del Mar Loop, it sort of got that kind of vibe. A lot of strange things, a lot of fun activity, and it was awesome. I loved the trip. We went to like this winery and saw like some Frankenstein movie because it was kind of Halloween time. We went to In-N-Out Burger, and if you haven't had In-N-Out Burger, you are missing out on life. Go to the Southwest. It's terrific. It's phenomenal. It's great. We saw a lot of people. We paid more than we should have for t-shirts and hoodies and all kinds of stuff along the boardwalk. And we even went to the beach once or twice. Like, but here's the thing. My version of a vacation involves a lot of seeing the city, seeing the sights, meeting new people, making friends, trying new foods, finding new little discoveries, holes in the wall, that kind of stuff. Maybe a little bit of history stuff. Like, that's my jam, right? For my wife, though, like a vacation is put me on the beach and leave me alone. But I don't like the beach. it's sandy and it's hot. The water tastes gross. I'm not a big fan of the beach. But the problem is, friends, we didn't really have that conversation beforehand. Yeah, so like, first week together as a married couple, like we are on this awesome vacation that neither of us are like terrifically enjoying because we don't really know what the other one has in mind. It was, for her especially, a rude awakening to like, hey, this is your inside cat kind of husband. Just enjoy. It gets worse, though. It gets worse. We get back from our honeymoon, and about a week later, it's my wife's birthday. I don't know why we scheduled like that sort of, like there's Thanksgiving, birthday, Christmas, like, excuse me, too many holidays. So, we've been married all of 2 weeks, and it's time for someone to rise to the occasion and set the pace for how birthdays are going to be celebrated in our family. So I step up to the plate. Big ol' swing and a miss. It was bad, guys. It was awful. So, like, this was before I was diagnosed with ADHD, and I just thought, like, my scatterbrainedness was just, like, part of life for everybody. Apparently not. She's, like, way better. It's, like, amazing. I don't understand how it works. But in my head, I think I was just, like, dreading, like, oh, I'm gonna screw this up, so I, like, postpone as long as I can, eventually screwing up. I think I waited till, like, the night of your birthday, right? Yeah, like, and I go out, I'm like, I'll be right back. Not going anywhere. And she had given me, like, some suggestions, like, here's some ideas, here's some, like, things, but by that point, like, I had very little time, guys. There was, like, the clock was ticking, the window was closing. And so, like, I'm going through the list, like, that's not going to get here in time. I have to order that online. This was before Postmates, so, like, I can't order anything to be delivered. And, like, running shoes, I don't know, like, what size or why you would run for recreation ever. Like, I can't do that. Like, we've been married 2 weeks. How am I supposed to know, like, what kind of, anyway. Last on the list, easiest option, fastest option, most expensive option. It's a bad idea. I got her the set of pots and pans that were on the registry that we didn't get as a wedding present. How's that for sending an unintentional message, right? Guess where you belong. Truthfully, it is a miracle. Like, that was another rude awakening. Like, she, in her family, birthdays are a big deal. Like, there's a cake that goes along with it, a big birthday dinner, presents, like, the whole shebang. Family comes, like, into town. Like, birthdays are a big deal in the Stein household. Not so much for Voruses. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, there's one birthday, maybe, before I was 16 that I can actually remember. Like, it was the one where we had a party for some reason. Some of my friends came over. But, like, just birthdays weren't, like, that big a deal. Another sort of thing where we, like, just didn't really realize, oh, this is what you wanted and, like, expected and... So yeah, and I think every year I have continued the legacy of bombing birthdays. Sometimes I do it in advance, so I'm getting better, I guess. Baby steps. Sometimes we have those rude awakening moments, right? And sometimes they're like a big thing, sometimes they're like a little change. I want to turn the question around to you guys. What's some kind of rude awakening you've experienced in your life? Maybe at work, maybe with family, friends, school, whatever. Talk to each other. You're not going to get in trouble for talking. Like, talk to each other for a minute. What's a rude awakening you've experienced in life? You guys somehow sound less awake than first hour. Anybody have a story they want to share with the class? No? Are you sure? I heard some laughter. Scott?
Children.
Absolutely. You get home from the hospital and you're like, this is mine now. Nobody, like, checked. Like, you good, man? You got this? Just, here's a baby. Yeah, excellent. Excellent. Here, Scott, I'm going to give, oh, I left my cake backstage. Sorry. You'll get that later. Sometimes these sorts of moments are pretty innocent, usually in hindsight, like pretty funny. Like on days that aren't my wife's birthday, she can look back on and laugh on all the ways that I've let her down. Sometimes they're a little more serious though, right? Like I've been learning over the last year or two a lot about the racial disparity and inequality that exists within the St. Louis region, within the country, and within the world as a whole. And my heart has just broken for the way that too often, I think the church is complicit in those divisions, and too often we're sitting on the sidelines not doing anything about it. In that process, I've learned about a new holiday. We celebrated a holiday last week, right? Who knows what it was? 4th of July, more formally called Independence Day. Crushing it. You guys are great. It's the day that we officially declared independence from Britain and said, hey, we're moving out of your basement. And this is like, you know, we're free. And even in that moment, the document says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal with unalienable rights endowed by their Creator, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yet when that document was penned, when it was signed and put into effect, there was something like 500,000 slaves in the colonies. They weren't free. And the new holiday that I learned about is called Juneteenth. And it's a shortening of June 19th, and it's a celebration of the day in 1865 where Union troops rode into Galveston, Texas, and officially announced by General Gordon Granger, how's that for a name, that the war is over, the Union has won, the slaves are free. For you history buffs out there, June 1865 is a full 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. Nearly 3 years after it was announced. And for that time period, those slaves were still not free. For much of American history, those slaves were still not free. And the way I look at the 4th of July has shifted, because I've seen it from someone else's perspective. I've seen it in a little different context. In fact, one of my friends on Instagram posted about this the other day. That's her on the right. She's actually the one who took our wedding pictures. She posted a very well-said message about Juneteenth, and I'd like to just read it for you. I'm wrestling with Independence Day because I'm still unlearning. Unlearning that benign firework displays and free concerts are a celebration of only one group of people, white people. At its core, it ignores a people group that stayed enslaved for nearly 100 years after July 4th, 1776. The African Americans have fought for their freedom beyond the letter of the law, which was kickstarted with the Civil War, and the holiday that is unknown and never celebrated in my community, Juneteenth. I have only authority over myself and responsibility to share knowledge with friends whose ears are open to listen. As I participate in parades, potlucks, and firework displays, I can use this year to look around and see who is missing and what we are not saying. This was an opportunity for me to talk to my children, to remind them that not everyone, even today, is born into America's freedom. This is a day to kindly have conversations with those who may be unaware or have turned a blind eye to the reality of how July 4th withheld independence to a specific group of people while simultaneously proclaiming freedom for all. Next year, as I work toward unlearning what true independence means, I hope to also celebrate Juneteenth. I hope in the year leading us back to the summer fun celebrations that I have more experience empathizing with my black brothers and sisters because we've had open and honest conversations. I hope to help educate my children in this process so they aren't faced with the same amount of unlearning that I am wrestling with. I hope in my own community I see real change happen as a result of acknowledging this hard but real truth. The definition of freedom is varied and has not become an automatic gift for all. Shift your perspective. And truly, we go through those shifts in perspective all the time. Sometimes they're small things, sometimes they're big things. And my hope today, as we celebrate Christmas in July, because we're doing it at a different time of year, a different context, we're not distracted by the snowmen, the Christmas lights, the incessant buying of presents and mall Santa Clauses, maybe we can peek a little deeper and get a taste of what is under the surface, and maybe see the Christmas story in a new light. So we're actually going to go to John chapter 1 to read the Christmas story. Usually we look in Luke or Matthew and see like the shepherds, the star, all that stuff. And the Bible nerds among you might be like, Elliot, you are sorely mistaken. There is no Christmas story in John chapter 1. You are a noob. But I would contend that there is a Christmas story, in fact, in John chapter 1. And I think it's a really beautiful story, especially for today. If you guys were around when I was up here last in February, we were talking about one of the Psalms, and I compared it to a diamond. When you turn a diamond and look at it in different ways, the light refracts differently, and you can see different qualities of the stone come to the surface. And I said that psalm, that section that we were covering that day, was a lot like a diamond. And you can look at it and turn it and see different themes, different elements, different repetition, different things about the psalm come up as you look at it from different angles. But guys, the Bible is like a diamond as a whole. And as we come back to the same story about Christmas, or the same story about the prodigal son, or the same story about the Good Samaritan, over a lifetime, we can look at it at different angles and in different contexts and see different features come to the surface. So I hope that we can do that for Christmas today. So if you are already in John chapter 1, great job. If you're not there, go ahead and turn in your Bible or in one of the Bibles in the seat under you. That's page 860, I think, if you need a page number. Don't be afraid to use the table of contents if you have to. I have a trivia question to ask, though, while you guys are turning. We celebrate Jesus' birth on December 25th. Does anybody know how we got December 25th? Not hypothetical, not rhetorical. If you know it, you get mad props and a cake along with Scott after service. Anybody? No fair if you were here last hour. Excellent job, Doug. Crushing it, like always. Come see me after for your cake rewards. So, a couple of elements enter into it. First of all, the earliest Christians didn't celebrate Christmas, didn't celebrate the birthday of Jesus, weren't really concerned with it. They were much more concerned with a different holiday called Annunciation, the day that the angel spoke to Mary and said, like, hey, surprise, you're having a baby. And they would celebrate that. And there was sort of like this poetic balance that they thought Jesus' life had, that he was announced, Annunciation, and he was crucified on the same day, same date. So that day, March 25th, served both purposes. And that was a big celebration in the early church. Count forward 9 months, you get December 25th, because we're good at math. But in the year 313, the emperor of Rome, Constantine, allowed Christianity to become an acceptable religion. Like, you won't get killed for being a Christian anymore. I like that. And 10 years later or so, Christianity became like the official state religion of the whole Roman Empire. So during that time, as it's creeping into the dark corners of the empire, there's all these like far-off tribes and pagan communities with all these holidays that they're like learning about, and those people are learning about Jesus. And a lot of those pagan rituals centered around lunar and solar events. One of them, the winter solstice. So like Christmas, like 4 days off, so we're like close. But the winter solstice is a big deal in a farming society. It's the shortest day of winter. It signals that spring is right around the corner, that more harvest is coming, that the sun, in a sense, is being reborn. And so as these Christian missionaries were going across the empire and saying, like, oh, you celebrate, like, the resurrection of the sun, and it gives you new life, and it brings new stuff. Like, we got that too. But it's not just the sun that's being reborn. It's the very Son of God who was put to death and is reborn and is giving us all new life. So they sort of adopted this, like, time frame and, like, Christmas, maybe. Maybe it was Jesus' birthday, I don't know. But, like, we have this moment in history that we can celebrate, because that is the moment that splits history in two. Everything is counted either to or from that for us. Maybe he was born on December 25th. Maybe he was born in the springtime. I don't honestly know, but I don't think it really matters. So if you're in John 1, we're going to look at the Christmas story from a little different angle. Another thing we sometimes think is that, like, Jesus was born and, like, he was like, hey, guys, I'm from God. And people were, like, surprised. The Old Testament is full of pointers and, like, hyperlinks saying, like, someone's coming. Someone is on their way. Someone is going to be setting things right. Someone is going to be showing us how to be this new humanity. And if you guys write one thing down today, let it be this. Bible Project Tanakh. Like, I know that's a weird word. It's just like a fancy Hebrew word for the old, for what we call the Old Testament. Go to YouTube to put that in the search box. There's like a 13-minute video that, like, oh, so good, so good. But all of the Old Testament, all of the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures, point towards this one who's going to be coming, who's going to be saving everything and going to turn this whole mess of the world around. And that is Jesus. So, without further ado, John 1, starting in verse 1. In the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He existed in the beginning with God. God created everything through him, and nothing was created except through him. The Word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness can never extinguish it. So if those words sound familiar, in the beginning, they're supposed to. It echoes the opening lines of the whole Bible, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And in the beginning, God speaks into existence the sun, the moon, the stars, the heavens, the earth, the water, the plants, the life in this world. And John is telling us that the Word was there. That's sort of like this Greek philosophy thing that kind of eked into the New Testament from the time. The Word represented sort of this, like, divine wisdom, divine truth, this personal force of God in the world. And it's through that Word, John is saying, that everything was created. And when John's talking about the Word, he's talking about Jesus. He didn't just show up in a manger one day and say, hey, how's it going? He was there at the very beginning. Not only that, God created everything through him. How good is that? The Word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone. Not only did the Word create everything, Jesus created everything that we see. Jesus was God. Jesus was fully God, stepped into his own creation. And in verse 1, it says the Word was God. And we could get fancy, and we could talk about Greek, and we could talk about how that particular grammatical construction is called an anarthrous preverbal predicate nominative, and you guys would, like, score a bonus point in Bible Bowl or something, but we're not going to get into that. Suffice it to say, John is telling us that this pre-existing Word, this Jesus, this Christ, was God. Another dude named Paul writes this in Colossians, "For God in all his fullness was pleased to live in Christ." Again, Jesus was fully God, according to these writers. In John 8, Jesus himself says, "I am the light of the world. If you follow me, you won't have to walk in darkness, because you will have the light that leads to life." God is, Jesus is God, and he is the light of the world. And he says to everyone who's following him that you can live in this light. You don't have to be overtaken by the darkness. You don't have to be brought down by all the problems you see in the world. You don't have to be frustrated by the evil that's everywhere, including in ourselves. The light illuminates the darkness, and it pushes back the darkness wherever it may be. So the question that I ask myself, that I want to pass along to you, is what's the darkness in your heart? Yes, Jesus can and will illuminate whatever parts of our heart that we give him, but too often we're clinging to something. Saying, no, not here. I'll just keep this in the corner over here. What's that for you? What's the one part of your life that you would rather it be dark instead of illuminated? If we skip down to verse 10, "He came into the very world he created, but the world didn't recognize him. He came to his own people, and even they rejected him. But to all who believed him and accepted him, he gave the right to become children of God. They are reborn not with a physical birth resulting from human passion or plan, but a birth that comes from God. So Jesus, the Word, God, created everything, then he steps into his very own creation. And darn it if they don't miss it. The whole Old Testament is pointing towards this guy that's going to come. He's going to be a new Moses. He's going to be a new Elijah, a new David, this new humanity. And they miss it. Not only that, but the people who should have known, the people who knew the Tanakh, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, backwards and forwards, who should have seen all the pointers, rejected him. That's like this show, Undercover Boss. If you've ever seen it, sometimes it's the funniest thing in the whole wide world. Like, imagine the McDonald's CEO, right, goes undercover. Like, I want to check out what it's really like to work at McDonald's. So she gets, like, a job at a franchise on the fryer, like, just all day, every day. French fries, chicken nuggets. French fries, chicken nuggets. French fries, chicken nuggets. McChicken, French fries, chicken nuggets. Over and over, all day long. And she's there to, like, learn and figure out, like, what's the culture like? What's the organization like? What is it like to be a person that is actually making the things that I am selling? Jesus is sort of like that undercover boss. He's down there on the sly. He's like God with skin on, which is the grossest way I can think to describe it. But he's not there to figure things out. He's not there to learn things. He's there to share his life and his light and the truth and the wisdom that is the Word, that is God. But they reject him. It's like if that McDonald's CEO working on the fryer can't keep up with the demand for French fries and she gets fired. How ironic would that be? That would sell movie tickets like no one's business. Jesus is like undercover, but they reject him. But there's hope. To all who believed him and accepted him, he gave the right to become children of God. Children of God. Adopted into the family of the King of the universe. Amazing. So me and some of our volunteers and some of our high school students just got back from a trip to Big Stuff. It's our camp for high schoolers on the beach. I don't like the beach, but I like the trip. It's a good trip. It's just the beach. I hate the beach. Sorry, I'll be done. I'll be done now. And it was last week, and they talked a lot about this idea of being a child of God. And I think it was a trip, honestly, that was good for me in a lot of ways, probably more so than for some of our students. And one thing that has been just sticking in my head over and over again is the idea of labels. We all wear labels in life: husband, father, son, daughter, mother, engineer, accountant, homemaker, pastor, number one youth pastor, if you've seen the t-shirts. Some of those labels are positive, but some of them aren't so much. Insecure, scared, doubting, uncertain, aimless, hopeless. And I think the one that's been stuck with me for a while, failure. Some of these labels come from outside of us, other people put on us. Some of them come from within ourselves, in our own insecurities, our own fears, and our own internal self-talk. But the challenge and the invitation is to let Jesus change that label. He makes us children of God. And if we can, if we let him, he will take away all these labels, all the scars associated with them, and he'll put on the one that matters more than any other, child of God, if we'll let him. So what labels are you wearing? What labels are you carrying around with you? Are they good ones, bad ones, positive, negative? Where did they come from? Other people imposing them on you or your own creation? And what would it look like for you to give up that label and let Jesus put on the one that matters more than any other. If we go down to John 14, so the Word became human and made his home among us. He was full of unfailing love and faithfulness, and we have seen his glory, the glory of Father's one and only Son. So the picture there is like camping. I don't mind camping. It's not so sandy. It's dirty, but it's not so sandy. The picture is like camping. Jesus sets up camp in the neighborhood. He puts his tent up, he settles in, and he moves into the neighborhood. That is how committed God is to humanity. That is how much he loves us, that he is willing to step out of eternity, out of heaven, and live as one of us. The technical, fancy theological term for it is called incarnation, so you can stick that in your back pocket and impress your friends later. The idea that God became a man. Somehow. It's weird. It's confusing. I don't fully understand it, but he was God and man. Not half and half, but fully both. For us. He showed his commitment. He showed his love. He showed his dedication to you and to me through that incarnation, through that presence here with us. So my wife and I are in the process of buying our first house. We're really, really excited. And if everything goes according to plan, we will close on Tuesday. And I could not be more excited. We've been living with her parents for like 7 months now. And I'm just ready to be like in my own space, ready to be like at a house by myself for even like 5 minutes. It'll be awesome. It'll be great. I'm excited. But I've learned a lot. I've learned that there is an astounding amount of paperwork and gears and decisions and complexities and all this stuff that goes into buying a house that I never would have dreamed of. Like, it's truly astronomical and insane. Like, I just think, like, we go into this process and we're like, how complicated could it be? You just like say, hey, do you want to buy this house? And we're like, yeah, sure, okay. Do we like shake on it now? And that's, and we walk away. Like, it seems like it should be so simple, but it is utterly complicated. To say and to actually put into practice that we are committed to this plot of land in this neighborhood, in this part of the city, in this part of the state, in this part of the country, in this part of the world, that this is my neighborhood. And as complex as it might be for you and me, and hats off to anyone who's done that more than once, good grief. As complicated as it is for you and for me, it must have been immeasurably more complex for Jesus to step into humanity. But he did it. And he threw his lot in with us and said, I am with these people. I am the God that loves them and is present with them each and every step of the way. He's moved in. And the question for us is, are you letting him? And are you choosing to live with him as well? It's one thing for Jesus to say he wants to live, he wants to move in, knocking at the door of your heart, to use a confusing metaphor. But it's another thing for you to say, yeah, to accept the deal, to let him enter into your life. And then we got to ask the same questions. Are there parts of our neighborhood that we're not letting him? Are there parts of us that we're not allowing him to speak into and show his truth and wisdom in? The last section we're going to read starts in verse 16. From his abundance, we have all received one gracious blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses, but God's unfailing love and faithfulness came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but Jesus, but the unique one, who is God himself, is near to the Father's heart. He has revealed God to us. So Jesus incarnates, I don't know if that's a verb, but we'll pretend it is, comes into humanity, and he shows us what God is like. Because God is like this abstract concept, and I heard a quote that I liked recently. Every time you say God, you say less than God. It's just so big we can't fully wrap our minds around. But we can understand a guy walking down a street in Jerusalem saying some smart things. And Jesus shows us what God is like. The questions that other people have for us about God, the questions that we have about God, they can be answered by pointing to Jesus. He shows us what God is like, and he reveals God's grace to all of us. So the law in the Old Testament was given through Moses, and that's like how God says, like, this is what it looks like to be part of this new humanity, part of this new tribe that I'm setting up. This is what it looks like to be the people of God. It was the law. You had to obey this stuff. You had to do this stuff. You had to make this sacrifice, this offering. Don't do that. Oh, definitely don't do that. That was the law. But Jesus brings us God's grace, this unmerited, undeserved favor that we could never earn. And that's a hard shift for us to make. Talk about shifting perspective. That's tough. I think we, more often than not, prefer the law. In Western civilization, in the United States, in the 21st century, we understand things like cause and effect, personal responsibility, you reap what you sow. We get that. It's hard for us to wrap our minds around just an undeserved, unearned gift. But that's the shift Jesus is calling us to make. We can live in grace because of Jesus. One gracious blessing after another. And sure, yes, Jesus does call us to behave a certain way and to act a certain way and to put off our old selves. But that's a tension we have to figure out. Where is the grace in our lives and where is the holy living in our lives? And for the astute observer, next week we start a sermon series talking just about that. So come back next week. It'll be great. Doug will be back up here. I'll be done flapping my jaw. It's going to be awesome. But that's a tension we all have to wrestle with. We all have to figure out between grace and the law. So which do you think characterizes your faith more? Are you working to earn righteousness? Are you working to earn your way to connection with God and do the right things and say the right things and believe the right things? Or are you depending on Jesus and his amazing, undeniable grace? The Christmas story is about more than just a baby born in a manger. It's about more than just a death on a cross that forgives us of our past stuff. Yes, there is stuff in our past that is forgiven, is gone because of this baby that was born. But it's so much more than that. Jesus changed the future of all of his disciples. He changed the future of humanity. He changed the future of the people in the early church, and he can change the future of you and me. And that's the whole reason he came. He entered into humanity to change our futures. What could your future look like if you let him in the driver's seat? If you let his light illuminate your darkness? If you let him move into every part of your heart? How could your life be different in 6 months, in a year? How could your relationships change? What's Jesus calling you towards in that time, and what's he calling you away from? The band is going to come up, and we're going to sing one more song. And while we do, I want to give you guys two thoughts to ponder, to think about. I love the word ponder. It's a great word. I'll give you two thoughts to ponder. First, have you let Jesus move in? Is he actually a big part of your life? Are you living your life with him in the driver's seat, or are you still hanging on to your own self, your own direction, your own trajectory? And maybe you need to make that decision for the first time. Maybe you need to make that decision for the first time in a long time. But have you really given Jesus a spot in your life? And the second thing is, what labels are you wearing? Are you wearing labels that you've put on yourself? Are you wearing labels that other people have imposed on you? Or are you wearing labels that the God of the universe has given us graciously and freely as a beloved son or daughter of the King of the universe? Let's pray. God, thank you for today. Thank you for the time that we have here, for the grace you've given us, for the futures that are changed, and the families and the trajectories that have changed because of your blood, because of your love, and because of your mercy and grace. I pray that during this time we would be honest with ourselves, that we would be honest with you, and that you would just speak to our hearts and guide each step. Father, we love you, and it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.